This is the current federal tax developments for the week of January the 13th, 2020. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and your State Society of CPAs. This week, we're going to take a look at a few things that have happened as we've started the new year, and things are happening a little more rapidly now, so we have a lot more stuff to talk about. I want to talk about a couple of issues that I've taken a look at in the SECURE Act that I think may have been overlooked by a lot of people. Certainly, I didn't pay attention right off that these things were there. So I want to discuss a couple of issues that have come in conversations on online discussion forums. And so we'll talk about how those work. We have a case involving an ESOP that lost its qualified plan status. And it's interesting, even if you don't do ESOPs, but you work with the clients who have qualified plans, or you work with qualified plans in general. Because we'll talk about the things you have to do to make sure your plan remains qualified and is qualified to start, and how you have to operate your plan. We have a discussion here about the fact that the IRS has opened up the electronic filing season for business and has given us the date when electronic filing will start for individuals. So we have some information to give you on that at this point. That'll make that somewhat helpful, we hope, to get these things started. So we'll talk about that stuff. We also have a case coming down here where we talk about the collection statute. We don't talk about it often, but we're going to talk about when the 10-year statute runs, and more importantly, what's the starting date of the statute. And that, in this case, turned out to be significant, because while the taxpayer believed the IRS had filed after the statute had closed, in reality, we discovered that the IRS had filed a couple of days before the statute had closed. And it became important to understand the exact date that it was deemed that the tax was considered assessed and the collection statute began to run. We're also going to talk about a couple of cases that deal with penalties and an issue we've seen coming back from the Grave case early from a couple of years ago. Question became an issue of when did the IRS give supervisory approval for an assessment of penalties against the taxpayer, proposed assessment of penalties against the taxpayer. And we're going to talk about how the tax court is working that out. They had a loss in the Second Circuit, reversal of a tax court case there, that led to the question of when the IRS gives supervisory approval, that has to take place before a penalty essentially can be proposed to the taxpayer. And the issue of what the IRS has to do, what the point in time is at which that approval has to exist, is one that we've been working out now for the last couple of years. And the tax court this week actually had three cases on the issue. We're going to talk about two. We're going to skip the Chicago Cubs case because I think some people may have already read about that case. And it was really one that didn't break a lot of new ground. It was more interesting because who was involved. We'll talk about the two that broke a little bit of new ground in terms of being published cases. So we have a couple of issues working there. So as it stands right now, we'll get ourselves running. I do have a couple of broadcasts coming up this week. Want to mention those. First, on the 14th, I will be doing a Cal CPA broadcast, current federal tax developments updated for the 2019 end of year tax bills. Again, I realize it's short notice if you haven't signed up yet. I wanted to remind you that we had that happening at 6 a.m. Pacific and 8 a.m. Pacific. It'll run on Tuesday the 14th. Now, the same day, I'm going to be doing a session that is just the SECURE Act for the Idaho Society. Your choice between the two is pretty simple. If you've already been through update for the year, but you want the SECURE Act, and it's going to be 4 hours of pure SECURE Act and the other parts of the Further Appropriations Act of 2020, you want the 4-hour version. If you basically have been putting off your update because you wanted to cover the new law you figured Congress would pass, then this one is the one you want. And yes, it has been updated. Yes, it's good. We recorded this on January the 2nd. I think that's really important to understand about a update course is through what date was it recorded. It was the 2nd, so you should be able to get your information together for that. Also, on January 15th, we'll be doing the Advanced Partnership Issues course. This will feature the new partnership audit regime as well as TCJA changes to partnerships. That's 6 a.m. Pacific, 8 a.m. Pacific. If you've not walked through the new partnership audit regime, probably not a bad idea. That's one you should be up to speed on now. This will be the second year we're going to be doing returns under that regime. So you really need to understand how you could opt out, how you stay in, all those issues, and whether you want to do that. And also on Friday, 199 Cap A, in case you want to have a refresher on all that as the year goes on, we'll be doing 8 hours on January the 17th on 199 Cap A, 6 a.m. Pacific, 8 a.m. Pacific. Again, many of our state societies offer these programs to their members through their catalog. You want to go check online and see if these are available for you there. If not, you may want to ask your state society. Some of them may not have added these courses because they were added later, so you might see if you can get in and get them on so you can get your discounts there. Otherwise, you can always go to calcpa.org and register there for them. But definitely, if your state society is a participant, you want to register through them because that will give you the discount. So let's go ahead and talk about the course. Let's talk about what we've happened this year. And there are a couple of interesting items on the year-end tax bill. And so we're back with the same Further Appropriations Act of 2020. And the interesting part is qualified charitable distributions and post-age 70 and a half deductible IRA contributions. And they're kind of interesting because we have some issues regarding them. What happens in this case is if you make a post 70 and a half deductible IRA contribution, that contribution reduces your qualified charitable distribution. Remember, the QCDs, if you're 70 and a half or over, you can make a contribution from the IRA directly to the charity. It does not go into your income. No Schedule A deduction. Now, some might say, well, that's an offset. No, actually it's better to have it come this way. Two reasons. Number one, it does not increase your adjusted gross income. There are a lot of tax issues, including Medicare rates set for those who are over 65, that depend on your adjusted gross income. There are other tax benefits, like, you know, the percent of income that the medical deduction is allowed for is tied to AGI. So there's a lot of AGI issues that could be negatively impacted by having $100,000 of additional IRA distributions. And you can count these as your minimum distribution amount. And again, 70 and a half, remember, that's still the ones, and this is still hard-coded 70 and a half, which is interesting under the new law. So you do not have to worry. Even your clients who are going to be turned 71 in 2020 will be able to make this qualified charitable distribution, even though they're not required to take minimum distributions yet. So it'll be an interesting aside. But remember, the new law also said beginning in 2020, those who are over 70 and a half are going to be allowed to continue to make IRA contributions, assuming they have earned income or their spouse does. We have some way to make that go in so they can make a deductible IRA contribution. To the extent they claim a deductible IRA contribution, they're going to have to reduce future qualified charitable distributions out of it. And it is future, current and future. It's kind of interesting as it goes. So if you claim a deduction a year you reach 70 and a half, it will affect the taxpayer if they ever make a QCD. And if this works, I'm hoping that it does, I'm going to be switching over on my screen to Excel. So those of you who are on the online version, you should see this in Excel. I'm going to clean one little thing up there. They just noticed the display. So we're going to take a look at this. Now, remember, it only affects you if you make a deductible. You get a deduction under Section 219. One clarification yesterday on the California listserv, somebody asked about, well, the SEP contributions do this? The answer is no, because the law specifically says 219. SEP contribution deductions are allowed to the employer under 408, which is more interesting. So it's not a 219 deduction, not a 219 deduction. A SEP contribution into the IRA will not have this impact. So let's assume we make a deductible contribution in 2020. We're over 70 and a half, and in 2020, we make and claim a deduction for $5,000 going into our IRA. Now, probably everybody understood right up front, and when we read it quickly, a lot of summaries would have told you instantly. Let's say the same year, we make a $25,000 qualified charitable distribution. You have to reduce that. So $5,000 of that QCD will be considered taxable income. And that means you get a $5,000 deduction on Schedule A, which, by the way, if you can't itemize and if $5,000 doesn't help us get there, we may not get any benefit from it, but we get the $5,000 there and we still get excluded $20,000. If the next year we make another $25,000 contribution, since we've already recovered the $5,000, we don't have a problem. and I'm going to clear that little thing because Excel is going to want me to say it, think it's an error, so it's going to work with that. Okay, that's great. Well, how about this? How about we have the same thing, except we don't make a contribution in 2020? In that case, the $5,000 carries forward. And in fact, the $5,000 will carry forward even if, you know, we wait 2 years, 3 years, it doesn't matter. If we make a $2,500 contribution in 2021, that's QCD, we'll have to pick that up as income and on Schedule A, and then the remaining $2,500 would live to the next year. Now, you know, the issue, why is this true? Well, the theory is they don't want you getting a $5,000 deduction for funding the IRA and then effectively getting a second $5,000 deduction for having, you know, had it ignore the pull from the IRA account. That's the theoretical of how it looks. That's the way Congress looks at it. So remember, the key takeaway here, though, is whenever you make a contribution, once you reach age 70 and a half, any future QCDs, at some point, if we make a qualified charitable distribution, you're going to have to reduce that qualified charitable distribution, even if it's in a later year, even if it's 10 years later that you first make your first QCD, you're going to have to reduce that QCD by the amount of the over 70 and a half contributions we've made in the past that we haven't yet recaptured. So again, if we make a couple of them, see, again, I do 5,000 there. So I did 5,000 in 2020, 5,000 in 2021. I make a $2,500 contribution in 2021. We reduce that, and that means I've got to pick up that on my 1040. And again, the deduction would go to Schedule A. But now the next year in 2022, I make a $25,000 contribution. Well, since I made 10,000 deductible contributions in 2020 and 2021, I've only recovered 2,500. I've got to recover the 7,500, which will now be considered to be a taxable distribution with a charitable contribution on Schedule A. And then I get the exclusion only for the 17,500. Interesting rule how it works. Also in that bill that some people didn't notice, when the change in the kiddie tax, there are a couple of changes here. First, temporarily, we're exempted from the special rules of 59J, which is our, you know, minimum tax effectively exclusion amount, is we don't have to get this real minor number there. And then secondly, what happens is, which I think is the bigger issue, we all knew when the Secure Act came out that when they did the kiddie tax fix, that you were going to be able on 2018 return to use either trust rates or the parents' rate. Remember, the problem here with the kiddie tax is if the parents' marginal rates were really low, the tax for the kid went through the roof. If they were, for instance, let's say, receiving a survivor's annuity from the Department of Defense, which is where this came up big. So we're going to allow, though, because again, if your parents were in the max rate, then using trust rates actually helped you. So we're going to now allow them. We said, well, you know, that was a benefit in 18. We're not going to force you to go back and pay more tax. Well, by the time they passed the Secure Act, we were at the end of 19. Congress apparently decided at that point in time, because people had gone through the whole year, the law had not passed, they had been planning for the kiddie tax to be able to use trust rates, that we're going to allow trust rates for 2019 as well. So that's also a takeaway that I don't think I've mentioned before. But you should be aware of that. They added 1 year to the time that you can make a election to use the trust rates or parents' rates for kiddie tax. Okay, and again, it's the end of the year. That's almost certainly why it got added. Now let's talk about our first case of the year. Or let's say, yeah, we got this first case that we've got, which is a disqualified ESOP. This is the case of Ed Thielting, Inc. versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2020-05. So this is the Thielting issue 2020-05. We have a lot of problems here with, you know, this ESOP. So let's talk about what Mr. Thielting's problems were. Well, Mr. Thielting had an ESOP, and he has his business. His business, actually, the only thing this S-Corp got was a 50% interest in a partnership that operated a business Mr. Thielting was involved in. And Mr. Thielting formed an S-Corporation, contributed the partnership interest in there. Okay, that's all well and good. But his father, who's a CPA, and who actually, this is the third time he has an ESOP in tax court. So we've been here a few times with his father. His father sets up an employee stock ownership plan. Now, of course, the only employees of this plan will presumably be Ed Theo King and Ed Theo King's wife. We're the ones that were going to apparently be the people that expected to benefit. And obviously, it has no other employees. Well, you know, we get all kinds of issues here on plans on that, but ignore that. We're going to go just with the plan document here, ignoring any other potential issues about this structure. Okay. Now, the issue becomes for this plan. So he forms this corporation, right? This corporation is formed in March of 2006. It adopts the plan in March of 2006. It adopts a February 28th fiscal year end. We won't get into how and why that S-Corp could do that. Just accept that it did. So it has a February 28th fiscal year end because we don't get an explanation in the case about how it was okay for this S-Corp to have a February year end. And it's only relevant for one issue here we'll get to. So here's the catch. For a qualified plan, you really need to have two things true. Qualified plan, and there are two key tests involved. For a plan to be qualified, number one, it has to have a document that contains in it all of the relevant terms required under Section 401A of the Internal Revenue Code. And that 401A goes on for quite a while. In fact, as I recall, 401A runs, I think it's got subsections from 1 to 34, and some of those subsections are pretty messy in and of themselves. So there's a lot of detail. Go take a look at 401A, little a, and you'll see all kinds of things that you have to qualify with. Well, your plan's document has to qualify with that. And the problem is, though, that over time, Congress changes the rules. Right, we've had things added, removed, changed, modified. So on a regular basis, you need to go back in and update your plan document to take into account the changes that have occurred. Normally, when Congress makes changes to the law in this area, either they provide or the IRS will provide via announcements a date by which you are supposed to have these amendments in place. And generally, you have to operate the plan as if it was so amended prior to that date. But it doesn't matter if you keep following the law. If the plan document's not updated by the date the IRS has told you you have to get it updated by, then you've got a plan form that is not a qualified plan document any longer. And it opens up at least the potential on exam for disqualification of your plan. What happens with disqualification? Well, that whole tax deferral and the deduction with no current inclusion for the employees, all that stuff kind of goes away. And what normally happens is it is considered to be a distribution in a case like this to the owner as of the first date of the first year that's open for assessment. How's the IRS get away with that? When it may have been disqualified earlier, well, the way they do is they say that, well, you took the position on all prior returns, it was qualified. We're not going to let you now change it and say, oh, sorry, the disqualification was years earlier, right? You know, sorry, it never was qualified. So, you know, sorry, you can't do anything to us now. No, they'll pick it up then. So let's talk, though, a little bit more about, you know, the issue there with the plan document. The second issue is, you have to operate your plan in compliance with the law and the plan document. If you don't follow the written document, which is your plan, that also is a disqualification issue. Right? So either violate the laws, we don't do something that 401 requires, or, you know, an operation, or we simply don't follow our own plan document. Then we have operational failures. A plan can be killed for either. This plan has problems in both. First, the first key problem was that, remember, we adopted this plan in March of 2006. The taxpayer never produced any copies of any amendments that had been made from 2006 to the current day on the plan. A number, which are discussed in the plan, in the opinion, there were a number of required changes to plan language that had taken place between the date this plan was adopted and the years finally under consideration before the court. The fact that it was never updated means that as of the first required change date, nothing else being wrong with this plan was potentially subject to disqualification on that date because it didn't have its document fixed. Now, before people freak too much, if you notice this before the IRS does, there are programs, the IRS or Department of Labor, either one can catch you here on a plan. You can go back in and under various programs qualify for relief though for which you generally have to pay a penalty fee coming in. But you will be kind of, you know, retroactively, we will ignore the fact that your plan's fouled up. As well, as a practical matter, at least in my experience, while the IRS may come in, Department of Labor may penalize an employer who has an updated the plan document on an exam. If it's a plan has lots of people covered and lots of them are rank and file, not owners, they're not very likely to disqualify. But if the only person covered is the owner, the chance of disqualification goes way up. So we have a problem right away because we've been ignoring all the requirements to change the plan. Now the taxpayer claimed, no, the plan was really changed. But you know what? My dad kept all the documents in his office, and the IRS showed up and seized all my dad's firm's documents. I said, there's been other litigation going on. So, hey, we've got these issues. The court said two things wrong with that. First thing is, you had been asked for these documents by the IRS over 2 years before anything was seized from your dad's office. So it's not as if you didn't have a chance to show you'd amended the plan. Secondly, they said, you're not allowed to rely on your CPA to keep copies of documents for you. You, as the taxpayer, have to ensure that you have all required documents. So, tough luck. You cannot prove it was ever amended. Your plan has a severe documentation failure problem. But here's what gets weird otherwise. Now let's get to the way that they operated the plan. Okay, in this case, this ESOP was adopted by the plan and the ESOP. So we incorporated the company on March 10th, 2006. And the plan required that an employee could not enter the plan until at least they had completed one full calendar year in which they had had over 1,000 hours of service. Now the plan's adopted on March 10th of 2006. You can't have one full year, no matter when you treat that testing phase, as having taken place until March of 2007. But the plan ended in February of 2007. Despite that little problem, the plan, in essence, the S Corporation made a contribution on behalf of Mr. Theo King for that year ended in February 28th of 2007. There's a problem there, right? As well, the next year, we had a rollover contribution from his wife. Now, okay, that was more than a year later, so we don't have this particular problem, but she never got a W-2, and by the way, neither did he. Now, there's no earnings. So, here's the catch. The court said, look, first thing is, for Mr. Theo King, even if he was an employee of the company, he could not have entered the plan by the end of February of 2007. So, any amount you have a non-qualified participant allowed in the plan, that's a no-no operationally. You're not following the plan document. Number two, in neither case did either one of them get paid any salary. And they're saying, look, if they're not employees, they can't be in the plan. Now, of course, what he was doing was the plan contribution was just perfectly offsetting all income of the S Corp. And being a good, I mean, if you're going to go ahead and go, you know, be a hog and go for all tax breaks, he's not wanting to pay any salary, we can presume, because he doesn't want to have the FICA paid, right? He read about that detail too, right? He liked that idea. So, of course, he took no salary. So, bottom line is, he says, you're not an employee. He says, I get it. I didn't get a paycheck, but I did lots of work for the company. And because we're owners, we wait till the end of the year and we see whether there are, whether it's financially prudent for us to not put the company at risk. You know, so the company's not put at risk, how much salary can we take out so it's not, so it's financially prudent? And the court said, I'm not going to worry about that financially prudent side for a second here. He said, you have no evidence of how many hours you worked. You haven't shown us anything that you had worked 1,000 hours. Yeah, you don't just get to assume that. Now, did the plan have to require 1,000 hours? No, it did have to require they were an employee. So that's a little problem that you might have had anyway. And did it have to require the one-year waiting period? No. But it was a boilerplate document they used. It had that in there. And very often we see companies decide that we don't need to worry about these rules, you know, as long, you know, when they impact the owner. So yes, everybody who's not an owner has to have 1 year of service, but the owner comes in immediately, right? Everybody who's not an owner, or you know, like the child of an owner, well, they have to be over 21, but the child of the owner could come in the plan when, you know, she's 16. It's like, huh? You're not allowed to ignore it for those people. That's a qualification problem as well. Remember, no compensation? Well, they're saying, here's your problem. Your contributions are in excess of the limits, both for deduction of a contribution under 401 and allocation to an employee's account under 415. That's an operational failure. Your plan document says we're supposed to stay within those, but you didn't. So there's operational failure number three, right? We admitted him when he wasn't allowed to be in there, right? We admitted then the wife, another participant, wasn't allowed to be in there. We've done that, reported them on all the returns since then as participants. We have this problem every year. We've also now made contributions to them, to their account, to the account for Mr. Theo King, and it's way in excess of the limit. So we have that problem. And then there's a final problem. This is an ESOP. If you have an ESOP and your shares aren't publicly traded, which his, of course, weren't, you have to have an independent appraisal. Now, independent appraisal, part of the requirements of the regulations is it can't be performed by a related party. And we take a look at 267 and 707 for a related party. Mr. Theo King, because he owns 100% of the S Corporation, is deemed to be related to the S Corp. Okay, that's Mr. Theo King, the son. And his father, under the attribution rules, is deemed to be related to him. So his father, by extension, becomes a related party to the S Corporation. His father is not allowed to perform the appraisals required annually for an S Corporation. As well, his father did not sign the appraisals. Now, they claim, well, look, we should count this as substantial compliance. Because, I mean, those are just technicalities. The court said, A, we don't see it as just technicalities. We think the independent appraisal requirement is in there for a reason, because they thought people might abuse things. And then secondly, right, you know, you failed to sign anyway. You know, you failed to sign. We think these all taken together fall far short of substantial compliance. But his dad said, I got through a court case, which actually we wrote up on the website, back in 2017, where you said I was an independent appraiser for another ESOP account. Court said, you're correct, that happened there. But say, but look at this other case where we said what you did was not good. Remember I told you three times before the court? We said, but even ignoring that issue, you were not the father of the 100% shareholder in the other case. So the fact that you were seen okay in that case has no effect on this case. The plan fell apart totally. Again, check form, check operation. Otherwise, your plan falls apart. Hey, it's e-filing site. We're ready to start e-file dates. This is fun. The IRS, this is when the IRS opens the 2019 filing system for individual filers on January 27th in a news release and their modernized e-file status page. So these are released. The Modern e-file status page had an announcement about business e-file on January the 3rd, and the announcement about the 2019 filing season for individuals came on January the 2nd. Business e-file started on January 7th, so we're now underway. If you've got a 11/20, you want an e-file, this calendar year, you can do it now. We're allowed to do that. S corporations, partnerships, all those kinds of stuff can now be electronically filed. We're good at that point. That includes trust, by the way. They also can be e-filed. Individual e-file date, that's not going to start right away. It's going to be a little delayed versus the norm, which is around January 15th. This year, they say they will start accepting returns on January 27th. Now, I should note, a couple people noticed on the e-file date for January the 7th that they actually were able to submit on the 6th, and the IRS took it. In some cases, your software allowed it to try, and it worked. My guess is maybe they'll be open a day or two earlier than the 27th. That's just the day they're promising for this purpose, or maybe 27th itself. But at the very least, you have days to start. So your clients that are wondering, when can I get this filed? Can we get it taken care of right now? You can at least give them a date of saying, yep, look, here's the date that I'll be able to hopefully submit your returns. Next case is a collection statute case. This is United States versus Coles. Case number 3:18 CV 0025 for the United States District Court of the Southern District of Ohio. This came out January 2nd. We begin the new year of 2020. This is a case of an estate tax. Now, this is an estate tax. The tax was imposed. It was actually an exam. And we're looking at six figures of estate tax that's due. Now, the estate involved closely held business. Based on that, the estate received, asked for and received three one-year extensions of times to pay the tax. I mention that because that's what's going to change us from a 10-year statute to a 13-year statute on the issue for the collection statute. And why that's important is because the results of this basically apply regardless whether it's an estate tax or income tax or whatever tax. But, you know, we got to get into why we're looking at 13 years, not 10. It has to do with that special provision that allowed an extension of time under Section 6502A1 to extend the time for 1 year, and you keep asking the service, and they can grant multiple 1 year extensions to the estate. The estate asked for an extension three times. Then after that, that was the end of that. Then the estate never paid the tax. Now, in the interim, even though the tax was never paid, the assets were distributed to the heirs. And, you know, and the closely held business in this case was distributed, as I recall in this case, to the executor's sister. So the executor got rid of all the assets, closed the estate. There's still this six-figure estate tax due, right? So the question becomes the 13-year statute, right? Now, you're an executor. One of the things you're not supposed to do is close up your estate before all tax issues are covered, right? Minor detail. You should assure that that didn't happen. Well, here the catch is, we had signed, the taxpayer had the IRS exam, and on May 27th, 2005, the taxpayer had signed Form 890, which is the waiver of restriction on assessment, collection of deficiency, and acceptance of over-assessment, estate and gift generation skipping transfer tax form. Okay, so they had consented to the assessment of tax, basically agreed to the exam number, on May 27th, 2005. The IRS received that document, and they didn't tell us how the estate knew this, but the estate claimed they knew it, on June the 2nd, and it was recorded on July the 4th of 2005. The IRS goes to court on July the 2nd of 2015. Should say 2015. If you look at the slide on the video version, it's really 2015, not 2005. So here comes the question. Is July 2nd, 2015 too late under these facts? Answer, the taxpayer says, yeah, it's too late. They said, look, really, the statute should have started on May 27th because we consented to the assessment on that date, voluntary consent. They said, but at the very worst, it should have started on June 2nd when the IRS received our letter, right, that had the consent. And June 2nd, 2005 is more than 13 years, shall we say, or I should say on, July 2nd, 2018. How's that for the weird thing? Forgot the 13-year statute when I got there. It's more than 13 years after the IRS, you know, had assessed the tax. Initially assess the tax. So, you know, Sorry, guys, you're a few days late. The IRS says no. What governs this is the date the assessment's recorded on the IRS's records. And they make that claim by looking back at the actual statute. And that statute essentially says, per code section 6203, looks to the recording of the assessment date. That recording date was July 4th of 2005. Now, the taxpayer said, July 4th? You know, that's a federal holiday. The tax court said, the district court did not particularly worry about that as somehow proving that wasn't the date. They said rather, you know, as far as we can tell, it's that date. In fact, I'm sure the court's theory was, if anything, it was later than that date. You know, it was either recorded on July 3rd or it was recorded when they got back from the 4th of July vacation. So, you know, basically, whatever it was almost certainly not recorded. You know, that's not evidence that it was recorded back in June, you know, back around June 2nd. So the court said, nope, the data record of assessment is the date that starts the 10-year statute. What that obviously means, and most people collections know this, is you want the transcript. You're looking for date of assessment. If you are going to play the 10-year rule, you're looking at date of assessment. Now, obviously, in this case, the taxpayers weren't trying to play that rule. Well, they probably were trying to. But the catch is you've got to realize the date they need to get to was the date of assessment 13 years from that date, 13 because of the 3-year extra. So that was kind of an interesting problem in this case. So that's the background. Now, the final two cases I'm going to go over with here briefly. These are both interesting cases. They come from the Grave case. That was related to a Second Circuit case that came before that looked at when the IRS has to have approved the issuance of, or basically the proposal of a penalty, right? What is the rule under that case? And the issues we're going to look at here, under Section 6751B, the IRS has to, no penalty under this title shall be assessed unless the initial determination of such assessment is personally approved in writing by the immediate supervisor of the individual making such determination or such higher level official. Okay, so the key comes into what is the initial determination of such assessment, and what is the IRS's burden to show, you know, that they hadn't passed that date. So we're going under two issues here. So the case of Frost versus Commissioner, our first published case here, which is going to be published case 154 TC number 2, issued on January 7th. Okay, it was the third decision in 2 days on penalty issue, which is interesting. And the IRS, for two of the 3 years in this case, actually couldn't prove that they had gotten supervisory approval. So for 2 years, the taxpayer is getting scot-free off, no penalties, because there was no proof of supervisory approval. But in the third year, there was approval received. So in the third year, the IRS could demonstrate that they had received approval before they sent out, essentially, the notice of deficiency. So they had the approval on this date. They have the record of the approval on date A. And after date A, on date B, the formal notice of deficiency was issued. Now, the court had to decide one issue. Remember, the court has determined that the initial assessment, and to get the right term here, because this term becomes important, the initial determination of such assessment may occur before the notice of deficiency. Does the IRS have, and they've determined that has to be communicated to the taxpayer. The catch comes, is there a burden on the IRS to show that no other communication that might be that initial termination had been made to the taxpayer? The tax court ruled no. They said, here's the catch. You're going to ask the IRS to prove a negative. They have to prove they didn't send anything. Well, they're saying, that's not really a fair burden. The IRS has stated, now, here's our approval, here's the notice of deficiency. The tax court has said, clearly, we have ruled in the past that if nothing else, notice of deficiency is going to be that initial termination date. So, essentially, now the burden goes back to the taxpayer. If you're going to tell me that the notice of deficiency was not that initial termination date, show me the communication you got that was the initial termination. They're saying, so he said, that's fair. The taxpayer should have that document. So since they have the document, the burden's on the taxpayer to prove it. The second case it was involved in here was the Beller Woods case. This one produced a split decision of the tax court. There's a lot of disagreement about this one. This was on January 6, 2020. And here's basically the issue. Again, an exam. Penalties now are being discussed. And an agent proposed a conference at which various issues would be discussed, including, you know, what the IRS was thinking of doing on taxes, you know, for the issue before it, which was going to be a conservation easement. And then they also mentioned that they would be considering, you know, penalties for overvaluation. Okay. So that's all told to the taxpayer. We're going to have this conference. There is no supervisory approval of the agent communicating to the taxpayer that at this conference, you know, in essence, at the conference, having mentioned there, that we're going to have the proposal of penalties. Now, the question becomes, had there been an initial determination of such assessment by the agent at this point? Because if there has, there is no supervisory approval yet. With no supervisory approval yet, we would now have the point where the IRS would be cut off from assessing the penalties. Okay. So the question, is this mention of penalties under consideration a key? And this is a tougher call because, as the court points out, nowhere in the code do we have any time we ever referred to an initial determination of such assessment. Like those words are never commingled. So there is nothing really that tells us what that is. We can find an assessment date. We can find determinations dates, but we don't have a initial determination of a penalty assessment. It just, the words don't go together. But we're stuck with that. What does that mean? Well, the tax court said they did have supervisory approval before they sent out the 60-day letter. This was a partnership case. So this under TEFRA partnership, there's a 60-day letter to challenge to go to appeals. The 60-day letter sent out, which have appeals right to go to appeals, administrative appeals. The tax court ruled that in this case, for this structure, that letter, and in a similar case, a 30-day letter for a normal exam, would be the initial determination. Now, that's not necessarily clear that that's how the law should be read, and certainly a number of judges on the tax court disagreed with that. They pointed out that when Congress passed this bill, they didn't want agents using penalties as negotiating tools. And it certainly seems like bringing it up at that conference was using it as a negotiating tool. So their view was that no, the initial determination of assessment should go back to the first time there's a legitimate threat of the penalty on the table. But that's not the majority position of the court. The majority position of court said the initial determination of the assessment was that 60-day letter. Now, this is interesting because it was a very tight split decision, including one concurrence. So it probably doesn't tell us as much as other published decisions might, except we know for sure that that 60-day or 30-day letter is definitely going to be the initial determination. We just don't know if there's some informal conference proposed ahead of time, if that's going, that could also be qualified as this. It'll be interesting to see if the taxpayer appeals this. It will also be interesting to see if it comes up in other courts or if it comes up in other context, if tax court judges will attempt to distinguish the case. So you just have to keep your eye on that one. Well, you're running out of time for tax pre-tax season CPE, right? We're running short. It's January. The pickings get mighty slim in February. But most, you know, not maybe not most, but I guess these days most because we're doing a lot of online stuff. You know, there's still options left in January for some tax CPE if you're looking for it, right? Coming up, like I said, on the 14th this week, Tuesday, if you've not signed up for it already, you can sign up. It'll be a webinar from idcpa.org is where you can find it. You can sign up there. If you're a member of Idaho Society of CPAs, yeah, you'll get a discount. So go ahead and look there. It's not being done live in Boise. I will be doing it from Phoenix. So it'll be a Phoenix presentation. So no, I will not be in Boise, Idaho at the time. So tough luck. You know, you're going to have to live with me being here in Phoenix. But we will have this. It'll be 4 hours on the SECURE Act with a 100-plus page manual with the updates. So we'll talk about that 4 hours on the 14th. I also have live sessions coming up here in Phoenix. On January the 21st, I'm going to have 8 hours on fringe benefits, right? So you want to do fringe benefits issues. That will include some discussion of what the Secure Act did to fringe benefits and qualified plans. On January 22nd, I'll have 2 4-hour sessions, one protecting tax information, cybersecurity for the tax professional at 8 a.m., and getting to the K-1 partnership allocations under 704A and 704B. That'll be the afternoon session that day on the 22nd. Both of these offered at the Phoenix office and as webinars, and ASCPA.com is where you can sign up. And on the 30th, I'll be doing the course Real Estate Partnerships, Get In, Get Out, Get Taxed. That'll be an 8-hour session. That'll be the last session for me this CPE year, which, you know, CPE years run, interestingly enough, from May 1st to April 30th. And this obviously closes out the 2019-2020 CPE year. Not a whole lot of people want to take tax CPE in February and March and early April. Maybe late April. I actually did one last year for an industry conference in late April. But normally even that's too early. So we foresee our first return to actual CPE in May. And so while there'll be some options during that time to get some continuing education, generally, it's going to be self-study type options, maybe a few rebroadcast webinars. So January 30th, your last chance for live for me until we get out of tax season. That'll be Real Estate Partnerships, Get In, Get Out, Get Taxed. During this time, I'll also have some in-house sessions I'll be doing. So I will be going to locations in firms. If you're really desperate to get some, you could probably still get one added now. I realize it's probably going to be February. And it's a little late in the season, decided to book your updates. But if you're still looking for one, you can still talk to us about doing one. We're still there. This has been the Kernfeld Tax Developments. You can check our regular updates at kernfeldtaxdevelopments.com. You can also send any questions or comments to me, Ed Zollers at kernfeldtaxdevelopments.com. Got those during the week. You can follow me on Twitter, the address there, at Ed Zollers. I follow discussions on the subreddit on Reddit of Tax Pros. You can also find me on the discussion groups for CalCPA, which is available to anybody around the country who signs up for Tax Talk on CalCPA. And, you know, again, email me if you want some information on that, because getting in, you kind of have to know how to get in. And if you know how to know who to email, it's pretty easy to get in as a CPA. I also follow discussions on Connect groups on Arizona, Minnesota, and New Jersey societies where I'm members. So be sure to follow me there. If you're, you know, you can follow along there and I'll answer questions that come up. Otherwise, we'll see what comes up this week. Again, we're waiting on the 163J final regulations. Don't know when those are coming. They haven't left OIRA yet, so we still got some time, but we'll hopefully work with you when that comes up and try to help you get through that. Otherwise, tune back in for us next week here on Current Federal Tax Developments.